In early 1967, when the ideas of a statewide movement first got started, when Bennett, who was Area Director of Alaska, was confirmed in the Senate as the Commissioner of Bureau of Indian Affairs, he was required to give a 90-day report. In that 90-day report, he gave an overview of the Indian situation in America. He devoted about that much space to Alaska. And it said, based on the Treaty of Sessions and Organic Act and the Statehood Act, the Bureau of Indian Affairs was setting down to draw up a final solution to the land claims problem. And when I read that, there was a lot of stirring about the maternalism of the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and we got thinking that why should they draw up the solution in Washington, D.C., that we in Alaska should have something to say about it. So we wrote some letters in July, and the Tundra Times picked it up and gave it headlines, and we finally got a meeting in October. Some of the early efforts prior to this time was there was some national money put into Alaska. Laverne Madigan had come up here earlier. Nick Gray was one of the early movers. Roy Pratovitz and John Hope were in meetings in Fairbanks, I know, in 62. But there was nothing to unify the people on. Now, the issue that we unified around was the land claims. That precipitated, I think, the statewide movement. So in October of 1966, when we met, Mr. Lekanoff here served as the first chairman from October till April and drew up the bylaws that we operated under. In that first meeting in October, I remember when we opened the meeting, it was an election year, and there was a great fear that the Native vote was going to unify. And so we opened the meeting at 9 o'clock in the morning, and they go to press at 10 o'clock, and at noon, when the newspapers hit the story, in great big headlines, it said, "Native split." And immediately they quoted a bunch of us who hadn't gone out of the room yet, and they trying to drive a wedge, which didn't work, obviously. But out of that October meeting in 67 came our first land claims bill, which was eventually S-2020. Since that time, we've had a number of bills over the years, at least a half a dozen. I lost track of them about when they hit six. There were a lot of ideas kicked around in those early bills, and I remember when Udall came up here, he said that coming up on the airplane, he thought about a 10% royalty off from the offshore oils. And 10% scared everybody. So when we got to talking about percentages, we said 2%. And 2% was really more than the 10% he was talking about, because he was talking about 10% of the federal share, which is 12.5%. So he was talking 1.2%. And that's in the public eye, you talk 10% and they go wild. So 2%, although it was more, did not have the effect of saying 10% and turned out to be more. Now, I think that the AFN really got moving in October of 1968, and that was in Fairbanks. Prior to this meeting, every time we went to Congress, they would say, "What's AFM, and who do you represent, and how are you elected?" And before we got started testifying, we always had to go through how the delegates were sent in, and we had the elections. But when Udall walked into the meeting in Fairbanks, and there were about 600 people in the meeting, he was impressed. And from that point on, we were in a good negotiating position. And it was after that meeting in 68, in October, that we worked practically daily on Udall. And our thinking was he should set aside 40 million acres of land. And I guess he thought if he could justify setting aside 40 million acres, he could set aside the whole state, which he did, which was even better. hitting some of the highlights that stick out in my mind. One of the things was a speech in February 7th of 1967, when our governor, whose name appears all through the land claims issue, Governor Hickel, made a speech where he tied up every radio station in Alaska. I remember in Anchorage, of the four stations there, I couldn't tune in any station without listening to Hickel. And he said, just because someone's grandparents chased a moose across the country, what rights and land does that give them? And that was his first position on land. And I think that was on advice of one of his attorneys, Attorney General at the time, who was Donald Burr, who Flory remembers very well from a meeting we had in January of 1967. That was an exciting meeting. It was just like an old movie scene, these two lawyers standing up and arguing back and forth, and very emotional, heated, high-tension meeting. Also, the state's position at that time was the land freeze was going to drive the state into bankruptcy, that we were throttling the economy of the state, that it was irresponsible for faraway Washington people to stop Alaska's development, that it was a retribution to Alaska or reprisal against Alaska for going Republican and electing Nixon, and for punishment, Udall, as he was outgoing, was going to punish us. But and there again, another attorney, Ed Boyko, that was his favorite theme, and Governor Hickel followed his advice in saying that the state would be bankrupt in 2 years. But that prediction didn't come true either. Following the state's position of driving the state into bankruptcy and filing a lawsuit, State v. Udall, to lift the land freeze, came the confirmation fight, which was an interesting fight all by itself. Governor Hickel got off a plane in Seattle one morning and said, while he was walking down the hall with a microphone stuck in his face, he said, "What Udall can undo, I can undo with a stroke of a pen," meaning the land freeze. So the board of the AFN sent four of us back to Washington, D.C. to hold the freeze. And we spent 2 weeks back there under some very trying times, being accused of all kinds of things, opposing the nomination, which of course we weren't doing. Our responsibility was to hold the land freeze, which we did, and we endorsed Hickel on the third day of his hearings after he agreed to keep the land freeze intact and that he would not give any airport sites, right-of-ways, dam sites, homesteads, anything without going before the Interior Committee. So that was a significant accomplishment. During that time, John remembers some of the things that happened. There's one meeting I could hardly believe. John and I was in a room being lectured to by, strangely enough, one of our own attorneys, local attorneys, and we had some outright threats about how we were going to finance the land claims effort and how would John like the Tlingit and Haida money to be tied up for 5 or 10 years? That could also be done with the stroke of a pen if we didn't operate the way we should, like all good boys should. But anyway, we stood our ground. And I remember when the board sent us back, that was... they took the vote at 5 o'clock, and the plane left at 11. And I got a call at home about 9 o'clock from a governor's representative in Anchorage there, and he was down at the Elks Club, half drunk at the time. And I don't know if I should repeat the language that he used that night, but we wound up the conversation. I'll use it anyway. And he said, what do you guys think you're doing and all kinds of things? You're crazy. Everybody I've talked to think you guys are crazy for going back. And we talked a while, and he wound up by saying, you're no goddamn native, you're just another son of a bitch. And I said, thank you, I'm glad to know how you feel, and we hung up. But those are just some of the things that happened in that fight. And I remember in those early days, prominent people used to come up to me and edge me and say, hey, come on, you don't think you're really going to get the statewide movement, do you? You know the Tlinkets aren't going to work with the Eskimos. You know the Athabascans fought the Eskimos. They're not going to work together. And I always said, yeah, I think we will. You know, we will. I'm not too concerned that we can't work together. We do work together under crises. We followed the example, I think, statewide that the A and B set. If you look at the back of your A and B card, there's some major accomplishments. The A and B was formed under crises, and they faced a lot of issues and worked hard together, financing many of their own trips. What does concern me is that now things are pretty good, relatively speaking. And but I think we're in a crisis. We may not recognize it, but I think the decisions that are made now, if we make mistakes, they may not show up for some years. If we make the wrong investments, we're on a one-way slide, and the end result is failure. So I think that's why we have to plan very carefully about what we do. And those plans are going to be developed in the next couple of years. You know, from time to time, we'll beef about what the BIA does or doesn't do. But when I came out of the Yukon at 11 years old to go to boarding school, I think it was because of BIA that I did get a high school education, because there were no high schools up in that area. Now, as we plan for our youngsters' future, no one can guarantee that the BIA is going to be here or that the public service, health service, is going to be here in 20 years, 10 years. And that's why it's important that we plan carefully to guarantee the future of our children, because Alaska is changing. Strangely enough, the biggest changes are coming about because of the settlement of the land claims issue. That means it clears the way for the right-of-way and a pipeline. When the pipeline goes, they expect somewhere from 9,000 to 10,000 direct jobs, 30,000 jobs with all the service that will be generated by them, by the pipeline construction. And because the United States is going through a period of high unemployment, we can expect three people for every one job. And that means that Alaska is changing very rapidly. Now, nothing in the history of the United States tells me that the Alaska Native is going to be treated any different than the Indian is treated in Oklahoma or North Dakota. And that's not a very pleasant picture. And that's why it's necessary and vital that we ensure that our children have the tools to fend for themselves. Things are pretty good right now. We have 20% of the vote. Politicians listen to us. They come to our meetings. There are a few appointments. But when we get down to 5%, nothing in my experience tells me that those conditions will continue.
I also feel honored just to get a chance to address this convention about the Alaska Native Land Claims Bill. And I think perhaps part of the history of Tlinkit and Haida involvement should start out with how the lobbying effort, how the battle within the AFN infrastructure, and how the battle within the executive committee came out so that finally we were represented no matter where Tlinkit and Haida interests were presented. There were some interesting questions in the budget this afternoon. One of them concerned a $23,000 bill that was for travel and per diem for executive committee members. And I think there needs to be a little background in that light. One, since we've joined the Alaska Federation of Natives, we do not collect travel or per diem from that organization. We pay our own way. We pay our delegates' way to AFN board meetings. We pay our per diem to the people that we send to represent us. This is also true of the lobbying effort in Washington, D.C. I specifically asked a question from the floor this afternoon about the $250,000 that we guaranteed the Alaska Federation of Natives. The reason I asked that is because I knew that our cost in the lobbying effort was $23,000. We sent a full executive committee meeting, to the final sessions in the House and to the free conference committee where our interests were vital. You have to remember when you start a lobbying effort for Native needs, you start with a basic premise. One, you don't have any friends. Two, there's no justice. Three, there's no equity. You have to remember we're fighting for a minority member's needs. And when you fight those kind of fights, there are two ways to do it. Either you riot and raise a lot of hell, or you stay within the law and do it properly. I don't know whether I'm very proud of the Alaska Federation of Natives and the Tlingit Haida, but we've never yet strayed from without the law that somebody else wrote for us. We always stayed within it. Let me tell you about the lobbying effort. That was beautiful to watch, beautiful to be a part of. Because when it came down to the crunchy part, the Wednesday afternoon, if you don't compromise Indians, we're going home tomorrow, you can forget about a bill till April. This was doing free conference. And we sat there, all of our board, and all of the AFN board, and there was some discussion, so we went into executive session. Now you're beyond lawyers, you're beyond advisors, consultants. Really, you're talking about India. So we went into an executive session in Washington, D.C., in a small little hotel room. I forget the name of the hotel. And somebody said, hey, if it's a good cause in December, if it's worth fighting for in December, and we've compromised all the way down to where we can't compromise anymore, then maybe we ought not to compromise one more inch. Not less than $40 million, not less than $1 billion, not less than 2%. And it's amazing to watch not one dissenting vote. Now, these guys were putting their name on the line, putting their heads on the line. No bill was the threat. And we stayed anyhow and find out that there were other efforts. When I say there's no justice and equity, I mean there are other efforts that came into the bill at the last minute. They voted on a Thursday. On a Monday, there was a brand new land claims bill introduced. It was very simple. It was one page long. It said this, that no region in the state of Alaska could survive with the monetary picture that was presented in that bill. If you couldn't survive on your money, then you were going to have to survive on your resources. Where are your resources? They're in the land. Eventually, somebody was going to own our land, too. That came out. There was no timber rights for Southeast. We had timber rights, but they were severely cut and controlled by somebody else, not us. And just because John Borbidge gets up at 7 o'clock in the morning and has breakfast, he happened to walk into an office at 8 o'clock when no sane senator or congressman is around and find a copy of this proposed bill. By 10 o'clock, we had had all our friends, might as well mention Lloyd Meads, Patsy Mink, Senator Bible, who turned into a friend once he lost his land fight for conservation. And we got them to raise a little cane for us and holler and kick and scream because there had been no Native input into this bill. And we visited our Alaska delegation at 9 in the morning, and we said bad words back and forth to each other. And it's amazing that the bill was the product of a meeting of four elected people from the state of Alaska, two congressmen, a senator, and a governor. And once we found the thing, we couldn't find an author. Not one of the four elected people would own up to authorship or even writing. And that's just part of the effort. The ancient prejudices that come out in lobbying effort for Indians is an amazing thing to watch, too. The ancient prejudice within Indian groups is amazing to watch, too. Because in writing the bill for the Alaska Federation of Natives, there were some beautiful fights. There were fights to offset the Klinkenhaida settlement by $7 million. You know, they said, hey, you guys already got your $7 million. Until we got that much, we'll catch up to you. That was an in-house AFN fight. There was an in-house AFN fight on two formulas for how the money would be divided once it got formulated, once it got enacted. One was called a land loss formula. I lost so many acres, I'll collect so much for each acre I lost. The other was a population formula, which of course was our stand, that it needed to be, once the bill got enacted, it then became a people's bill, not an acre bill, not a resource bill, but a bill that belonged to people. So we fought that battle. Other battles, the simple inclusion of Klinkenhaida Indians into a statewide land claims bill. Figure that sometime if you want, that some people didn't even think we belonged there. And I think it's steady heads and a statesmanship posture taken by Emil Nadi, who was then presiding on the AFN, not only made our inclusion, but made us a viable part of that organization. Some other things that I think need to be said, I can't say. I'll gladly tell you one at a time down at the Quito's Cave. Some of the real hairy things that happened during this AFN battle for a land claims bill. I think that the most interesting, the most publicized, was that the Arctic Slope walked out on us one time. All of you read that. I happened to be in a meeting representing Klinkenhaida on the AFN board when they came back. And we spent 4 days in executive session that day. That week, I mean. That was a beautiful fight. There's been some wonderful, wonderful fights to get a land claims bill that means something. I think perhaps someday history will show that it was a fight worth fighting. History will also show that the natives of Alaska were winners, because Florey talked to you upstairs about 5 and 10 year plans, you know, and those are nice. Tomorrow you're going to vote on a regional corporation. When you get home, you're going to vote on a village corporation. But really, that's not what it is. Let me tell you plain and simple. The simple fact is there shall be about 15 regional corporations in Southeast Alaska. Florey talked about starting a bank. That'll have its own corporation. Florey also started about politics. That's going to have its own corporation. It'll be called COPE or STEP or whatever, PACE or whatever we want to call it. Florey also talked about housing. Eventually, there'll be a Southeast Native Housing Association, just like there's ASHA. There's going to be an economic development corporation. There is in effect now, just regionally. Those of you from villages will have to learn that there are tax loopholes, there are advantages to your existing IRA corporations that need to be used. Beyond your village corporation, beyond your local development corporation that Dick Stitt talked to you about this morning, You also need an economic development corporation in your village. So actually, while the bill tells you that there shall be a corporation, actually, if you handle things right, if you use your imagination, if you use the law, and frankly, if you're better than the bill, we're going to have enough corporations so that one corporation meeting a year will require more people than are in this room now. It's fabulous. It really is. Those of you that sat in Juneau in the special convention in 1968, when we took $7 million to continue this fight, have paid a price since then. Some people have called us fools for taking $7 million when we could have got 80. Now 80 is insignificant. When we talk about the $968 million, and when we talk about the 2% overriding royalty and our resources, we've not yet talked about the money that shall be interchanged between regions on the development of their corporations and their resources. We've not talked about sharing the wealth that the North Slope will develop in their oil. We've not talked about any of that. And this is why I think the most exciting part about land claims is not the fact that there is a bill. That bill is only a ways, a mean, and a method written by somebody in Washington, D.C., that this convention has to be better than. We don't have to be as good as that bill. We have to be better than that bill is. Otherwise, they shall control our destinies by that bill, and they shall control us, period. I don't know if it's possible, but someday I'd like to pile up every law, every policy, every idea ever compounded in Washington, D.C., deciding the lives of Indians. I have an idea that since the BIA is probably the second oldest bureaucracy in the United States, that we couldn't pile that paper in this room. And all those papers are how to run your lives. So is this land claims bill. That's all it is. It's a means, a ways, and a method to control your destiny. I talked more than I should have. I wanted to confine myself to lobbying, but I also feel that we shouldn't confine our thoughts or our imaginations to what's in that bill. When they say a village corporation, think better than that. When they say a regional corporation, think better than that. Thank you.